two papers by Dolan and Osborne. So this one was more in the spirit of this direct construction that I was explaining yesterday. And today we will discuss a method to actually find differential equations for the conformal blocks that Dolan and Osborne did in this paper here. And most of the rest is textbook material, so it's like the Di Francesco book on conformal field theory, or even Polchinski on some parts. So. Okay, so today I want to start by explaining a very useful way of taking care of conformal symmetry. So my counting, I think this was 0.7 or something. So the idea here is to consider the space, a bigger space. So we are interested in d-dimensional conformal field theories, but we'll start by considering the bigger space R d plus 1, comma 1. So if you want d plus 2-dimensional Minkowski space, and we consider points in this space. I'll write the label capital A for d plus 2 coordinates in this space. And I'll try to distinguish capital X as living here and small x, what I was using yesterday, living in Rd. So the idea is to look at the space of null rays inside this space, okay? So we will consider the space, the null cone in Rd plus 1, and you identify, so null vectors in Rd plus 1, and we identify vectors by a scale transformation. Okay. So I think I should draw a picture. I wanted to draw this before, but no time. So let me write this coordinates in a particular way. I'll choose two light cone coordinates, and then the d coordinates that we had before. So this guy parameterized Rd, and this guy parameterized R 1,1, so two-dimensional Minkowski space. So now, the map. Now I'll give you a map from points in Rd, so our real points in the physical space to this space of null rays. So the idea is to choose for each null ray, you choose a vector xA, which is a representative of that null ray, and a good parameterization of that is to write it like that, is to write it as 1 x squared and x mu. So this x is our real coordinate in Rd. Okay. So let me draw you a picture because I think it's easier. So the blackboard is two-dimensional Minkowski space. So this will be the x plus coordinate. This will be the x minus coordinate. And now outside of the blackboard, okay, somewhere outside of the blackboard, you know, if you can, it's the Rd, the other coordinates, okay? So the light cone is going to be just some, it's going to be this light cone here, right? And we can just, because of this scaling, we just consider the upper light cone, the we identify rays. So now you see what's happening. Do I have color? No color. Okay. You have to imagine. So look what I'm doing with this parameterization. So if you take x equals, little x equal to 0, that's just this point here, right? The point 1, 0, 0. And now the coordinate x plus is always 1. So essentially what you're doing here is intersecting this light cone by this hypersurface with x plus equal 1, okay? So
I can try to draw that something like this, and then going in the back also. You can see it like that. Is it clear? So you see, essentially, as you move this coordinate x mu in Rd, so the origin of Rd is mapped to this null ray, and now, for example, so x squared moves you in the x minus direction. So if you want a sphere x squared equal constant in Rd is mapped essentially in this picture to 2 points because we don't have enough dimensions to think. So it's like this is like S0. But so these 2 points you should think of as Sd minus 1. Okay. So from this picture, you immediately see that we're not actually, the light cone is not actually equal to Rd. It's equal to Rd plus a point at infinity. So there's this, the ray 0, 1, 0 is not in Rd, is really the point at infinity. So that's just the null rays in this Rd plus 1, comma 1. We say we map this to Rd plus the point at infinity, if you want. So why is this useful? This is useful because now, instead of using these coordinates in Rd, we can use these coordinates, which are rays in this bigger space. And now the conformal group on these coordinates just acts like the Lorentz group. It's just the Lorentz group acting here. Okay? So what I want to say is that there is a direct map. So, for example, in my coordinates, in my conventions, I should probably tell you my conventions for the metric. So these coordinates, I'm choosing that x squared is equal to minus x plus x minus plus x mu. Okay. So in this conventions, for example, the dilatation operator is just 2j plus minus. So you kind of see when you boost here in plus or minus, essentially you are changing the radius of the sphere. So I'll explain that more explicitly. But let me just put the list. I always confuse this p mu. Which one is p mu? Let me write it correctly. J minus. And rotations are still the rotations of in the transverse directions. So another thing is that here, whenever you choose, so essentially you can think of this parameterization of the null rays as choosing a particular section of the light cone. Okay, so you choose a representative per each light ray. Okay, so whenever you do that, then the embedding space metric induces a metric on your section. Okay, so if the metric that you find here is really just you take this x of xa of little x, and your metric is just taking dxa of little x, dxa, at ab. Here it matters, the indices, because there's a time. And this, if you just do this algebra, this trivial algebra, you really get the usual, the Euclidean metric. Okay? So really, the Euclidean metric is the induced metric in this embedding space. So I wanted to show you an example here of how these generators act here. So, for example, suppose you want to act on a point. Okay, take a, you want to try a dilatation. So in my minor conventions, dilatations, if you want to do a dilatation, you exponentiate your dilatation generator, and you act, you want to act on, say, a coordinate xa. Okay? So here, you just, is the, you just use the standard definition of these generators. Okay? So, so you just use that, and you take the derivative here. You will see that acting on this coordinate, essentially, so let me just replace what I'm going to say. What you're doing is, so j plus minus on this 1 x squared x. So you see, j plus minus is a boost in plus minus direction. So essentially, it shrinks one light cone direction and increases the other one, right? So this point goes, in this case, e to the minus lambda shrinks this one, e to the lambda x squared, and this one is invariant, okay? But now the point is that you just care, you rewrite this as e to the minus lambda 1, e to the 2 lambda x squared, e to the lambda x mu, sorry. This is x mu, okay? So, and now you can drop this factor because you see, we just identified light rays. The capital X's are not defined, are, you don't care about this overall scaling. So, so you see that, in fact, what you did was just generated a dilatation in the physical space. So this is an example. You can play with the other ones and you will see that Lorentz, this, just using these Lorentz generators on these vectors XA and bringing it to the usual form with a one here, all, generates all the conformal transformations. Ah, just a nice comment here is that even the, so this is just the generator, so the small, the connected part of the conformal group, but even the disconnected part, for example, an inversion is very easy to understand in this picture. An inversion is just a reflection in a, in this bigger space. So it's the reflection that interchanges the plus and minus light cone coordinates. Okay? So it's very clear that if you interchange and again you normalize x squared to 1, so 1 x squared x, if you interchange, you get x squared 1, 1 over x squared. X mu over x squared. It actually generates your inversion. Good. Okay, so this is just a technique to implement this kinematics. So now, now I want to show you that this is also very useful to understand correlation functions. So now you had, yesterday we were discussing operators, and in particular discussing primary operators. So, so now it's natural to uplift them to operators in this bigger space. They live now in this light cone. So this variable was in RD, and now this variable is, parameterizes the light cone. Okay. So how do you do that? You essentially say that they are the same in this section, and then they are extended to the light cone as homogeneous functions. So essentially, you you choose, if you have a primary operator of dimension delta, you you demand that its extension in the light cone is homogeneous of weight delta. Okay. So just so this is also useful, this parameterization is also very useful for tensor operators. So if you want to have an operator, say a spin one operator, say some operator with a label A, sorry, suppose you have some a vector operator in RD, so it's natural to uplift that to this space, but now A takes two more values, right? So it seems that you are increasing the number of degrees of freedom, okay? So, but in fact, what you should do is you impose a constraint. So there's a constraint that this uplifting of this vector has to be transverse, has to be this contraction of the vector at each point has to vanish. And then when you compute, and then if you want to recover the physical, if you want the real physical operator, what you do is you just project down using your transformation. Okay? So this map, capital X of small x, is just this initial map that I wrote there. Okay? But now you see, there's a redundancy in this description. So if I shift VA point x by some scalar function proportional to xA, then it will drop out here because of the condition that xA square is equal to 0. Okay. So this is a redundancy. Okay, it's clear, right? xA contracted with this derivative, it's going to be 0 because x square is 0. So in fact, this mu takes d values, a takes d plus 2, but you have one constraint plus one redundant, one gauge invariance, if you want. And so you actually are taking, it's just the same number of physical degrees of freedom. So before we move on to actually see this, how this works in correlation functions, let me just comment that in this language, you actually put together, when you compute correlation functions in this embedding space, you actually are computing correlation functions in all conformally flat backgrounds at the same time. So to move from one conformally flat background to another one, it's just a change in the section of the light cone, okay? So if I had color, it would be better. But suppose instead of choosing this particular one that I just explained that gives just Euclidean space, I choose a different one. Let me cut it like that, and then on the back like that. Okay? It's my freedom to do that. So what am I doing there? I'm just saying that now, my new parameterization, my new section of the light cone, maybe I should use a tilde, not to confuse, it's just the old one, so let me write explicitly, times the generic function of little x, okay? So at each point, I choose to rescale my vector. So in that way, I can describe any section of the light cone that I want. But now you see, again, you just have to compute the induced metric. Using this formula. And it's, you see, it's very easy to see that what you're doing is, so let's see. So what I want to say is that dx tilde is just d omega times the original a plus omega times d of the original xa. So now if you take the square of this, okay, the square of this, so the square of this is 0 because x squared is 0. The cross term is also 0 because xa with dxa is also 0 because x squared is 0. So you just get the second term. So essentially what you get
is omega square times dx a dx b eta b. But that's precisely the metric we had before. So what you get is that the metric is just a Weyler scaling of the flat metric. Okay? So all Weyler scalings of the flat metric can be described like that. Okay? So this is just the way they appear here. You'll see that what that implies is that you immediately have a relation for correlation functions between different backgrounds. So just by using that scaling relation over there. So I'm just saying that suppose you want to take O, so the physical coordinates, X, yeah, X1, O1, okay, some generic correlation function with this metric, omega square times flat, okay? This is, suppose you want to compute this, this physical observable in this background. So what you have to do is you just use the uplifted version. So you compute A at X tilde of X1. Okay, this is in the embedding, if you want. Embedding uplifting of the correlation function. But now omega, this X tilde is just equal to omega times the small X tilde, times the, sorry, the standard one that gives flat space. So now you can use this scaling. So what you get is that it's equal to omega of X1 to the minus delta 1, I mean all operators with scale, times the, now in the flat metric. Okay. So this is just exactly what we said before that happened for a conformal field theory. Correlation functions when you do a Weyler scaling of the metric are just very simply related to correlation function on the original metric. Okay. At what time did I start? This clock runs. Okay, so now let me show you this at work in correlation functions. This is what, 8. So now suppose, take the simplest case. Let's consider the two-point function of two scalar operators, two primary scalar operators, okay? Okay, let's first think they are different. Okay, let's say delta 1 and delta 2, okay? Dimension delta 1 and delta 2. So now, what can you write, what can it be? What can you write on the left-hand side? You see, so these are vectors in this in this embedding space, and the correlation function has to be invariant under this big Lorentz group. So the only thing you can write here is scalar products of x1 dot x2. Okay, so let me in fact define that. So if you compute with this normalization minus 2 x1 dot x2, you just go there and do this contraction, you get x1 minus x2 square, okay? So since this is the usual normalization, I'll use this convention. x1,2 is just this contraction with a minus 2, okay? So this can only be a function of x1,2. But now there's another constraint, which is this scaling, this fact that the function has to be homogeneous of weight delta in each of the points. So you see, you already learned something immediately, because this can only be a function of x1,2, but this one has to scale with delta 1, and this one has to scale with delta 2. So it's impossible if they are different, okay? So this is really there's a delta 1, delta 2. So I mean, only if they are equal, this can be non-zero. And then if they are equal, then the solution is just this. X1, 2, 2 minus delta 1. That's the only thing you can write compatible with everything. So this is a trivial case. But even now, cases that don't look are not so trivial in the original space, let's forget about this, also become almost as trivial in this language. So the three-point function is not so trivial if you want to do it in the original space. But here, it's equally trivial because you see, it's only a function of the scalar product. So you can only be like x12, x13, x23, nothing more. But then now you have to satisfy three independent scaling relations. Okay, so if you put here generic powers, alpha, beta, gamma, you get three equations that fix it completely. So you know the solution already, right? It's delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3 over 2. And this is really the unique solution of scaling plus Lorentz invariance. Okay, and there's some up to some normalization that I was calling this cis yesterday. Good. So I think, okay, like in this scalar case, this doesn't look so interesting. So let me show you what happens if you want to consider now a vector case. Let's consider this two-point function of a vector. Okay. So let's, now we already know it can only be a function of x1, 2, and to fix the weight, you just put here to the power delta, where delta is the dimension of this guy. That already fixes the weight. But now you have to take care of the index structure. So you have an index A and an index B. What can you write? So you can write a metric, AB, or you can use the points, x1 and x2. So one way is to use x2 A, x1 B. And since the scaling is already fixed, you should divide by x1 dot x2 so that this guy does not scale anymore. And now there are more options. There are more terms you can write. You can write things like x1 a, x2 b, and like x1 x1 ab, and x2 a, sorry, plus. X2, X2, B. Okay? These are all the terms that you can write. But now, first thing is that all these terms are irrelevant. All these terms are redundant because they are of this form. So there's always some point which is like the same point with the same index. So X1A, whenever you have X1A or X2B, this is redundant. It won't affect the physical correlation function. Okay. And then there's the other constraint that they have to be orthogonal. XA contracted X with VA has to be zero. So if you contract this with X1A, it has to be zero. So if you contract here X1A, to get zero, you have to put a minus sign here. And that's it. That's the only thing you can have. You fixed everything. Up to a number, of course. So you see, you get immediately, just from this playing with indices and Lorentz invariance, the form of the correlation function of two vectors. Good. So let's look at the four-point function. When you have a four-point function, you have something different, qualitatively different. So what happens when you have a four-point function?
what happens is that now you can form combinations that are Lorentz invariant and scale invariant. So scale in this sense is scaling along the null rays. So if you form the combination, you see, there's always a one above and below, so the scaling cancels, and it's completely Lorentz invariant, just made from contractions, from dot products of the vectors. So this is called a cross ratio, a conformal invariant cross ratio. And for the 4-point function, there's two independent ones. You can also write x14, x23. I think this is what I want. This cross ratio. Yeah. So now you see, now the 4-point function cannot be completely fixed like here, because any function of these cross ratios will still be conformal invariant. So there will be a lot of freedom in the 4-point function. So let me parameterize these two cross ratios by the following two variables, z and z bar, 1 minus z and 1 minus z bar. This is just a convenient parameterization of these two invariants. So you trade these two invariants by z and z bar. So then let me just write, because I'll use it later. So one way of writing this generic form of the 4-point function is the following. So what I'm writing is a particular choice. The only thing that has to work is that it's just a function of dot products and has to obey the correct scaling. So if you scale x1, it should scale if you scale x1 by lambda, this should scale like lambda to the minus delta 1. So you see that this does not scale with x1, this scales with x1 with this power, and this also, so where you sum the two, you get the correct scaling, and you can check for all of them. But this is a particular choice of prefactor, and then you have a generic function of the invariant cross ratios. So just to give you a picture, because pictures are nice, let me. Because otherwise this z and z bar is a bit of an unmotivated choice. The point is that if you choose x1 to be at 0, at the origin, if you choose the 4 points to lie in a two-plane, okay, and you choose x1 to be at the origin, and then x3 to be 1, 0, if you want this point here, and you put x4 at infinity, and then x2, some coordinates x and y, then these cross ratios, these two cross ratios are just going to be z equals x plus iy, and z bar equals x minus iy. Okay. So if you want, you can use this picture to have intuition about z and z bar. It's when you choose points like that, it's really moving x1, x2 in this plane is parameterized by the coordinates z and z bar. And you can always put the points like that. So you can use the conformal symmetry to send any 4 points to this configuration. Good. So now that we know how to actually work with conformal symmetry, let's try to go back to this problem of the conformal blocks. Any questions? No questions. I hope that means that I'm being very clear. So what we saw yesterday was that a generic four-point function could be decomposed in a sum over all the primaries that have non-zero three-point function. So we chose this particular channel, so one, two, to the primary k, and then k to 3, 4. So these were the three-point functions. And then there was this conformal block function. Sorry, 4. That depended on the positions. Okay? So I gave you a definition of these conformal blocks, but it was not a very practical one. I mean, you could start computing some terms that. I defined this by some infinite sum, so it's not very practical. So today I want to give you explicit expressions for these conformal blocks. So, but before we do that, so first of all, that is not known in full generality. So if these operators are not scalars, for example, it's not known what's the form of these conformal blocks. So I will focus on the case where these external operators, these four operators, are scalars, okay? Primary scalar operators. So then the first question that we should understand is, what type of primary operators can be part of this sum, okay? The primers that can be part of this sum are the ones that have non-zero three-point function with two scalars, okay? So what my question is really, what are the possible SOD representations or irreducible representations of the primary K? Okay, so we saw that all primaries are classified by scaling dimension delta and an irreducible representation of SOD. So in principle, you can have everything here in K, but that's in fact not true. Only a particular type of representations can actually have a non-zero three-point function with two scalars. So to see that, you choose a particular kinematics for your three-point function, okay? So
can I go back to the, I have a stupid question about the video. Why could we rescale just one point and not all of them at the same time?
Right, that is very important. It's very different. This scaling is not the dilatation, the global dilatation in flat space. That's the action of J plus minus. This is a different thing. This is because you're going to a bigger space. See, so this is really pointwise. It's more directly related with a Weyler scaling that depends on the point. You see, that's what more directly related. It's not just the global dilatation.
So you need that definition in order to get the motivation. You need to somehow to motivate why you decide to lift the operator in that particular way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to say why the correlation points for many operators must be invariant when I just rescale one of them, right? And your motivation is that I need that definition in order to get a general Weyl invariance, which was your first formula yesterday. Is it correct?
Yes, I think you can put it like that. But even when you then compute correlation functions like here, I mean, all this can be derived without ever appealing to the embedding, and it is correct. So this guess of this choosing this scaling along the light cone is also works in that sense, even without appealing to Weyl transformation. So it's.
I just don't understand how would you motivate it. What was your argument to say that it should be invariant when it should have a particular scaling when I just scale x1?
Yeah.
So you said, when I just scale x1, I should get some particular power.
Yes. So I'm saying that those are the rules that I defined at the beginning.
Yeah.
And what I showed is that all these rules give the consistent results with Weyl transformations of correlation functions and with conformal transformations in a particular.
They just seem to be stronger somehow, but they are not.
They're not stronger.
But it's true. I mean, from what you, it's not obvious that they are not stronger, right? From what you show. I mean, naively, or do you think it's obvious that they are not stronger?
Can they become more stronger for more points functions?
Sorry?
More points to the scale? Maybe they are not stronger up to 4 points, but then.
No, it's really equivalent.
You're always free to embed it anywhere you like. Right? I mean, you really only have this cross section where you that corresponds to the RD, and then you can make any rule that you like for extending it along the null direction.
Yeah.
And this one happens to be a very useful rule because it makes the scaling laws look simple. Is that fair?
Yes, no, I totally agree with that, too.
There's also the question how you motivate embedding, the original embedding on the null rate, on the light cone, and so on. Presumably the answer there is that you wanted to show explicitly how the SOD plus 1 comma 1 is the same as the conformal group in D dimension.
Yeah.
That's a function of the motivation.
I should say that this goes back to Dirac. Dirac did this in the 30s. Yeah. 40s or 30s. So let me go back to this question. So I want to then know what are the possible. So I want to compute a 3-point function between two scalars and a generic irreducible representation of SOD. Okay, so that I can write. Okay, let me write some tensor. Okay, with let's say L indices. So, since it's an irreducible representation, it will be some traceless tensor with some well-defined symmetry or anti-symmetry rules in this in its indices. But now, this is a function of 3 points, and I have the freedom to choose these 3 points. By a conformal transformation, I can put them where I want. So I'll choose to put this one at the origin, and this one, I'll choose to put the three operators in a line. So, like this point at the point x, this point at the point minus x, and that point at the origin. So in this configuration, it's clear that the result from this has to be something of the form x mu 1, x mu l, minus traces. Has to be something of this form. Proportional to this, some number, right? There's nothing else you can do. Or, well, if you want x squared to some power. But you see, if this was a generic representation, this will have some antisymmetric indices. So then this would be incompatible. So the only representation that can appear here is the totally symmetric representation of SOD. So what I'll call really spin L representation. Okay, and I'll label these operators O of dimension delta and spin L. So these are the operators that can be exchanged here in this channel. Good. So now that we know what are the operators, we want to find the explicit form of the conformal block. So to do that, where's the eraser? Jesus. to do that, I want you to consider the action of the Casimir of the conformal group, or in this language, the SOD plus one. So if you use these rules, the Casimir, in terms of the original generators, just reads like plus the Casimir of SOD. So now it's very simple to measure to the value of the Casimir in these representations
that can flow in the middle.
Okay, so in this state O delta L. So we just know that this is annihilated by K. You can use the commutation relations, and so this part gives just delta minus D. And then that's the Casimir of a spin-L representation of SOD, so it's L plus D minus 2. Okay? So now I want to use this to get a differential equation for the conformal block. So let's see what's the best way to do. I'll need some space. This I should keep. So first thing is that these conformal block functions, are in fact the full correlation function is conformal invariant. Okay. So what does it mean? It means that if you act with any of the generators at every point, so the complete generator, you get zero. Okay. Whereby acting, I really mean just this action defined there for the Lorentz group. Okay. So this is the statement of conformal invariance. Okay. So now what I want to do is to act on this conformal block function with the following operator. I think if you want, it's a partial Casimir. So it's AB, I'll act on the point 3 plus AB on the point 4, and okay, the square, okay? The Casimir, but not the complete one. If it was the complete one, it would be 0 because it's invariant. So just this one. On this function, okay. And now I have to recall the definition I gave yesterday of this function. So it was this infinite sum over the OPE coefficients. When you do the OPE between the operator O1 and O2, I was calling this OPE coefficients B. Or minus x1. Okay. That's 2 minus x1 because you're exponent at x1. And then you take all these derivatives. And act on the 3-point function of the operator OK at point x1 and the operator O3, x3, O4, x4. So now you see, this action in this function only acts on points 3 and 4. Okay, so it just goes through and just acts on the three-point function.
Okay, so it just acts here, one half of this J3 plus J4 squared.
But on the three-point function, it's invariant under the sum, under a complete rotation. So you can actually write here just JAB acting on 1 squared, because it's the same. But now you see, now this is just acting on a single operator, which is a primary. So it has a definite Casimir, which we just measured over there. Okay? The Casimir is just given by this. So what you get is a differential equation. So you get that this is equal to delta minus d plus L plus d minus 2 times the same function. So this is the differential equation. You see, JAB are just simple differential operators, defined by there. So this is a differential equation for the conformal block function. You see, I chose 3 and 4 because for me it looks a bit simpler, but you get the same result if you use 1 and 2 because the sum is 0. So now this is just simple algebra. So let me reuse this equation. So now it's very simple algebra. So now what you do to actually make use of this differential equation is first you write the conformal block just as a function of the cross ratios. So the conformal block transforms like a four-point function, so it has the same type of expansion. So I can put here just the conformal block. Or if you want the operator delta L being exchanged, and so I defined here a reduced function, let me call it G, that is just a function of Z and Z bar, okay? And now it's a simple, you just work through it. You replace this expression in that differential equation, you act with the generators and translate this action in X's to derivatives in terms of Z and Z bar. Okay, so that you just have a simple differential equation for this function of the cross ratio. So I wanted to write that before coming here. It's a bit boring, but where should I write it? So if you do that, the final result is that you have some differential operator acting on this function of Z and Z bar equals this Casimir. Times the same function. And this differential operator, I think I won't write it entirely, but it's just something like, I don't know, z squared, 1 minus z. It's second order differential operator in z and z bar. And it depends. Well, it depends on, let me just write one term that shows that it also depends on these external labels, but just on the difference, delta one minus delta two and delta three minus delta four. And all terms, so there's some more terms, which I won't write, but it's just a simple one.
How many more?
Okay, all right. Okay, and as the final one, which is a bit more important, at least for I want to say later, which is the only one that mixes Z and Z bar. Okay, that's it. And to have the correct, I think there's a 1/2. I divided by 1/2. So now the idea is that the conformal blocks are defined by this differential equation plus a boundary condition. And the boundary condition is just comes from the leading OPE coefficient. So you can check from what we did yesterday, we checked the leading and the first subleaving OPE coefficient for a scalar, but in general the boundary condition is just z z bar to the delta over 2, and then z over z bar to the L over 2. So by this I mean this is the behavior of the function when both z and z bar are very small, they go to 0. But it's important that to break the symmetry, you take z bar over z small also. Or if you want to, z bar goes to 0 first. In other words, if you have this picture, did I erase it? Probably I did. So z and z bar are these coordinates on the plane. If you just take the modulus to 0, you will see this scaling with the modulus, and then there's a function of the angle of z over z bar. And that's, in general, a polynomial of degree L. So this is just fixing, this is just picking the leading term of this polynomial of the, not polynomial, like e to the I theta L. In general, you have more terms. So this differential equation plus this boundary condition completely fixes the. Yes. Yeah, I just because I didn't want to carry too much labels, but yeah, there's also it also depends on delta one delta i's if you want, but it just depends on these differences, these two differences, this one and this one, but yeah, it depends. I just didn't write the label because I was lazy. So this defines the solution. So here's the solution. So you see, d equals 2 is particularly simple because the only term that mixes z and z bar is absent. So in d equals 2, This function of two variables factorizes as a product of functions of a single variable. So in d equals 2, let me write here, d equals 2, g delta L of z and z bar is equal to, you can write like h delta plus L over 2 of z. You see some function at L different. Plus the complex. I don't want to say complex. Well, this is for L bigger than 0, and this function h is so. Before that, let me just say that. For delta equals 0, there is only one term. It's even simpler. And this function h is just an hypergeometric function. So h of lambda is, and z is just z to the lambda f to 1 of what? Lambda plus delta 2 minus delta 1. So they're here, the parameters, they really depend. lambda plus delta 3 minus delta 4 over 2 lambda and z. Okay, so you can check, put in Mathematica, or if you remember your definition of hypergeometrics, they solve that equation and they have this boundary behavior. So that's the solution. So remarkably, d equals 4 is almost as simple. The point is that in d equals 4, I think it actually fits here. Dolan and Osborne found that in d equals 4, this function is also very simple. So what they did is that they realized that if they factor out this factor z minus z bar, or if you want, if you factor out this factor through this differential operator, it factorizes again. So in fact, you can write, so the rest is also factorized, and it's also written in terms of this function. So it's delta plus L over 2 of z, h of delta minus L minus 2 over 2 of z bar, plus, okay, complex conjugate in the sense that you interchange z and z bar. So this is useful to have these explicit forms. So in the workshop, there are some people that will explain exactly how to, you can actually use these explicit forms to put in the crossing relation and get constraints both for the dimensions of the operators that can appear in the OP and for the OP coefficient. So it's important to have this, but this is basically what we know. So d equals 6, it's similar. It's also slightly more complicated, but it's some simple transformation also gives us explicit solutions. But odd D, it's not known at all. And as I said in the beginning, this is only for external scalar operators. So if you want to have spin as in the external operator, then basically nothing is known about conformal blocks.
Is there a simple way to see that odd and even are distinguished if I look at that operator? I mean, it's just a number.
The only thing I can see is that when you go from d equals 2 to d equals 4, you have to put in this factor so that the operator factorizes. And when you go to d equals 6, you put like this factor squared. And again, it factorizes. So it feels like d, you wanted to put a square root, but then it's completely different. You branch cuts and that doesn't solve. But I have no more. Yeah, I don't have any intuition for the nature of this differential equation. Good. So this is the first part of the lecture.
Since you're on the light one, I wonder if this is related to the fact that the Green's function looks nice in even dimensions and it's very messy in other dimensions, messy Green's function. I don't know why it would be.
Well, I'm not sure. I can give you an answer, but I'm not sure if it will help. So I've studied like flat space limit of ABS CFT and recovering scattering amplitudes from correlation functions. And so in that process, you have to take a limit of these conformal blocks that go to partial waves of scattering amplitudes. And there you find this, that like the partial waves as a function of the scattering angle are much simpler in a even dimension than in all dimensions. So if you want, this is just a bigger space where you see that different difficult level of difficulty. So how much time do I have? I need to improvise.
So this is informal, so people can leave, you can have 20 minutes.
Page wise, probably as much as what I did now.
Are you free on Monday?
No. Monday I have to concentrate on science.
Okay, Saturday.
It's actually better. I prefer Saturday. Good. No, but this is simple stuff. So. No, this was not simple. But now it's gonna be simpler. So, okay, let me go on and we'll see. We'll improvise later. Where is it? So I want to very quickly comment on word identities. Really very quickly. So we had this expression over here somewhere. It's still here. Yes, that tells us that relates the correlation function in a given background, which is just a Weyl-Ruiz scaling of another background with the correlation function in the original background. So that from that identity, you can simply derive a word identity just by taking the infinitesimal version of that transformation. So, well, maybe I should write again. Okay, so we have some operator, some correlation function computed in a rescaled background, rescaled metric, and that's just. The same guy. This is another one. In the metric without rescaling. So now let's consider an infinitesimal transformation. Omega is just one plus a small delta omega. But dependent on the point still. So this side of the equation, how does it vary? So essentially, what you have to do is to vary this correlation function with respect to the metric. And multiply by the metric variation at the same point, right? By definition, and integrate. And on this side, what you have is that it's just a sum of minus delta I delta omega of xi times the same correlation function. So the variation of the metric in this case is simply two delta omega times the original metric. And the variation of the metric of a correlation function basically is just the definition of the energy momentum tensor. So you get this, you can write this as the correlation function of the energy momentum tensor inserted at point x times the original fields that were there. And you have to contract with the variation, so actually you get the trace and times the variation that depends on the point integrated square root of g. Okay, so this is equal to this also.
So the final answer is the right answer. So there was a half when you did the delta g.
No, but there's a 2 here, and there's a 2 in the definition of the energy momentum tensor as a variation. So I think the final answer is really like that. Okay. Yeah. So, and now essentially you can bring everything together. So you can write this as the generic variation as a dependent of the point. You have here the correlation function of the trace of the energy momentum tensor with generic insertions. And then you bring this to this side. So this will give you the sum over I of delta I. And then you have this delta functions, x minus xi, of the correlation function without the energy momentum tensor. And this has to be equal to 0. Right? I just wrote this is an integral, so there's some delta function. But now this is a generic function, so this integrand has to be 0. Okay? So that's your word identity. Is that this part here is actually equal to 0. So this, I won't comment on generally. There's more word identities coming, not from violet scaling, but from diffeomorphism transformation that relate the divergence of the energy momentum tensor correlation functions with other correlation functions. But this one relates a trace like that. But the point I really want to emphasize is that if this point x is not equal to any of the insertion points, okay, so that this delta function never contributes, what you get is that the trace of the energy momentum sensor inserted inside a correlation function is always 0, okay, up to these contact terms. So this is just the usual statement that the trace is really equivalent. The traceless is equivalent to Weyl invariance, tracelessness. And now I want to study how does that break down. And it's the best way to study it is not in this form of finite transformations, but in this form of how does the trace of the energy momentum tensor is not zero in general when you have anomalies.
Is this
Euclidean. I'm doing everything Euclidean. Yeah. So what's the problem with anomalies? So you know the general story. So anomalies are happen when it's not possible to regulate the path integral preserving all the classical symmetries of your action. So here, so in some cases, so you start from this action, it's Weyl invariant, but then you want to do the quantum theory, you want to do the path integral, and you have to introduce a regulator. And it's relatively easy to introduce a regulator that preserves diffeomorphism invariance. You can put some massive field, some Polyvillard regulator or something. But to actually preserve everything, including Weyl anomaly, it's in general not possible. So one way to formulate that is to study the breakdown of this condition, T mu nu equals 0. Okay, so T mu nu will be different from 0. So, but what can it be? The question is, what can it be then? So, since we preserved diffeomorphism invariance, it has to be something that has that invariance. And at the same time, it should be a local quantity because this is coming from a UV regulator effect. Moreover, it has to have the right dimension. So the energy momentum tensor has dimension d. So you need something with dimension d. So now you can essentially, you can write down all possible scalar curvature invariants that satisfy these properties, okay? So the simplest case is in d equals 2. In d equals 2, the only thing you can write is the Ricci scalar of your metric. So t mu nu in a given background is the Ricci scalar of that metric, okay? So you see, this has the right dimension, is length to the minus 2, if you want, or energy squared. And there's nothing else you can write, essentially. So the only thing that you can put here a constant. That constant is usually written, my notation for the energy momentum tensor, I think, is 24 pi. Because in 2D, usually you use a different notation for the energy momentum tensor. You divide by 2 pi, and it's not the standard definition that I gave in general dimension. So that's why that looks a bit different. So this C, probably most of you already know, this C is also the central charge in a 2D CFT. It appears in the Virasoro algebra. But for now, you can think of it just as a constant that characterizes this anomaly of the theory. And now you can play this game in other dimensions. So here in 2D, it was very restricted. You couldn't write anything else. So in D equals 4, so first of all, in odd D, there's no anomaly. And essentially, this argument is enough to show, because just the fact that you need to build a scalar made of curvature invariants with a dimension, with dimension d, when d is odd, you cannot build a scalar. You can only build scalars with the even dimension.
Yes, well, the C depends on kappa.
What do you mean? It depends on the CFT. It's a characteristic of the theory you're studying. If you change the coupling, it's a different theory. So, okay. Okay. Let me write that. So, Rob gave a very nice talk here in our group meeting the other day, and he explained higher dimensional anomalies and their meaning. So I'll just write in 4D, now you have to write something of dimension 4. So there are several possibilities. So it's usually parametrized like the square of the Weyl tensor. That's one possibility. And then there's another possibility, which is essentially the Euler density. So it's some. And in principle, you could try to put also something like a derivative of the Ricci scalar. But this is, in fact, so this constant, it's scheme dependent. Depends. So by adding local contour terms, you can change this constant. So this is not a good characterization of your theory. These two are constants, they characterize the theory. So now I want to, I mean, this is a very long story, so I don't know too much about it, so I encourage you to read Rob's papers and Janet and Misha are working on related topics. So
basically, the idea that all the structures have the same features.
Sorry?
Why all the structures have the same coefficient?
They don't have the same coefficient. It's different, no? C, A, A prime.
Yeah, but A multiplied by 3 different structures.
Ah, no, this is just a particular combination, right? So you have, this is also, you can also write this as a combination like that. So I'm just saying, this is a particular parameterization of the freedom. You could just take
I think Paul is asking why there is not one more.
Good question. I don't remember. Why?
Somewhere there was another restriction that they had to be violent. I mean, that's what that
because
vile, and then that's topological.
I see. Because when you essentially the anomaly tells you how it breaks, but then if you include the anomaly, it's vile invariant. Right? It's like the full thing is taking into account that. Yeah, sorry. So the question, I think your question is that why don't you just have one coefficient for this, one coefficient for this, and one coefficient for this, right?
Yeah.
And what Rob was explaining now is that there's an extra restriction, which is that if it has to be vile invariant. If you rescale the metric, you do a vile rescaling of the metric, the anomaly should not change. So that's why, so the vile tensor does not change, and the vile scalings, and this is a topological, this is the Euler density, so it's topological, so it also does not change, and there are continuous deformations. So that eliminates the third one. The third one is not
invariant. You mean its integral doesn't change, so it changes by total derivative.
Right. In fact, I really wanted to show you that how does the path integral change now under like integrate this anomaly in D equals 2. Okay. So in D equals 2, all metrics can be written in as a conformally flat. All metrics are conformally flat. Okay, so you can choose some conformally flat metric times some generic scale factor. So now this anomaly tells you how the partition function changes under an infinitesimal change. An infinitesimal value scaling of the metric. So if you use this conformally flat metric, then the anomaly is just this Ricci tensor, and the Ricci tensor for this metric is just minus two e to the minus two omega Laplacian of omega. So if you use that, you get an equation for the infinitesimal variation of the partition function. Okay. So if you want to compute the partition function in a generic metric of this form, and now study how it varies when you. So before I said this was zero. Okay. This was zero because the partition function was invariant. But now there's an anomaly. So the variation. So by this variation, I mean send omega goes to omega plus delta omega, an infinitesimal variation of the violet scaling. Now there's going to be a contribution, and you see the contribution is going to be again proportional to the trace, because exactly like I was doing there in that word identity, when you vary infinitesimal, you just bring down the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So in if you use this form, you get an explicit equation that you can actually integrate. Indices, otherwise you might get confused what is this. Okay, so what I'm saying is that the infinitesimal variation of the partition function is just proportional to the integral of the trace of the energy momentum tensor times the original partition function. And now I'm replacing the explicit form of the anomaly in 2D when you work in this particular metric. Okay? But now you see, this is just telling you that so the variation of this function is equal to the function times this factor here. So you see that the solution is something like you can integrate this infinitesimal transformation, and you will get something like the partition function on the flat metric times a factor which is just looks like a kinetic term for the so this depends on x for the Weyl factor. I think I got the normalization right. You see, now if you can plug this in to check, you can vary this. Okay, you get the same thing times the variation of this exponent. And the variation of this exponent, you see, is just is the usual thing that you do to derive the equation of motion. So this is box, it comes from this. So now you see, it's quite a mild effect. It's just rescale, so it's not exactly invariant, but it's just like an overall factor that changes. So for correlation functions of primary fields made of matter fields, if you want, This does not affect their transformations. So yeah, I wanted to do this because of something else, but now I need to improvise now, no? How much time do I have? Okay, let give me.
We'll continue for 15 minutes.
So yeah, now I want to do this. Then I can
split. We could schedule another time and do it for those who. Yeah, but when? Okay, so what else?
No, it's like I finish. If people want to come, they can last for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. So I think it's more efficient.
Yes.
No.
Okay.
I think you're going to hurt your arm if you put all of those pages on the blackboard in 15 minutes.
No, most of this is because I was computing at the same time. So it's not, I won't write all everything. No?
Okay.
Because I don't, I mean, I.
Yes.
It's definitely less than an hour. I won't have a.
Maybe at
least. Hmm?
Don't you want to mention the pilatons?
No, okay, let me just finish by commenting on modular invariance. Because I want to comment in modular invariance, we saw this construction of crossing symmetry as a definition of the theory, like some constraints on the three-point couplings and on the dimensions. But modular invariance gives additional constraints. So I think it's important to also understand how that works for higher dimensional CFTs. So, but before doing that, let me just then quickly review what modular invariance in two dimensions, the usual case, okay?
So the idea is we want to now, instead of just studying the theory in RD, we want to study the theory in a different topology, okay? So in a torus in particular. So we have some torus. So how do we describe this torus? We can describe like we have, so it's a two-dimensional space, so we have two coordinates, x1 and x2. And we can think of them as living on the plane, but with identifications. And I'll choose this, there's some usual factor of 2 pi that you put here. But the identification, I'll always make it like a nice square like that. So n and m are integers. Okay? So if you want, there's a picture of 2 pi, this is x1, this is x2. And I identify this side, and this side, and that side. And that's my torus. Now the question is, what's the metric? What metric do you choose on this torus? So essentially, in 2D, all metrics are conformally flat, as I just mentioned over there. But whenever you have that's just a local statement. Locally, you can always, using coordinate transformations and Wheeler scalings, you can make a metric flat. But on a torus, there's some obstructions. You cannot do it globally. So the most you can do is to bring the metric to this form. So tau is some complex parameter that parameterizes your metric. And now you can compute your partition function on this torus will be a function of this parameter tau that characterizes the metric. But now there are some symmetries. And the symmetries are very easy to describe now in this language. So suppose you take, you define new coordinates by the following transformation. So I think it's like this. Okay, where all these letters are integers. So you see, because they are integers, the new coordinates also satisfy the same identification, right? Because you're just mixing integers with integer, you're just mixing them with integer coefficients. But there's another constraint, which is the fact that in the new coordinates, you also want to map a single unit cell in the new coordinates should map only one unit cell in the old coordinates. So that's a statement about the determinant of this matrix. So the determinant of this matrix should be equal to 1 so that this map is 1-to-1. Okay? So that just means that this matrix is a matrix of SL to Z. A matrix of integer entries with a unit determinant. But then if you do this coordinate transformation, the metric transforms to the following. So it keeps exactly the same form as before, up to this factor that you scale out, and this but the parameter tau changes, and the way it changes is the following. So this is called a modular transformation. So
you want to. This is an action of the modular group on the parameter. So the statement here is simply that we started from a partition function with a parameter tau, then we do a coordinate transformation. The matrix just changes by a rescaling, which is actually a constant, so it doesn't even contribute for the anomaly. So then the partition function has to be equal to the partition function with this changed parameter, tau tilde, as defined over there. Okay? So this is a very strong constraint on the partition function of a conformal field theory on the torus, the fact that it has to satisfy this symmetry. So now I think So the point, okay, this part I really want to jump because you are getting tired. So it is well known that now you can also write this partition function just in terms of the spectrum of the theory, okay? So the point is that Z of tau, I was going to do that explicitly, but I'll do it after the first end if people are interested. Z of tau is entirely, or is determined by the spectrum. The spectrum delta i's, and if you want the representations, what spins do you have? Okay? And in fact, it also depends on this anomaly coefficient c. But it's entirely determined by this. Okay? So now you have a function that is entirely determined by the parameters that define your theory, by your CFT data, that has to satisfy this symmetry. So these are extra constraints on the constraints we saw yesterday. Okay? So yesterday I was saying, to define a CFT, you don't need to worry about fields. Just find deltas and the OP coefficient CIJKs that satisfy crossing and unitarity bounds, and you're done. You have a consistent CFT. That is true on the plane. If you want the theory to be consistent also in other topologies like the torus, there are extra constraints. In 2D, we know what these extra constraints are. So now I want to end by speculating about higher dimensions. So what happens in higher dimensions? Do we have extra constraints coming from putting the theory in non-trivial topologies? I don't know. But I know that there are torus at least. So at least that will give constraints, I think. But no, I think it's an excellent question, but no, it's not at all explored. In fact, the paper I saw that discusses it better is a very recent paper of Kyriakos. So, yeah, I think it's totally unexplored thing. Many people must have thought about that, but maybe it's too hard. I don't know.
In four dimensions, you cannot classify all the topologies.
But in three, you can, right?
In three, it's unknown.
Isn't this?
It's hoped that you can.
Wasn't this work of Perelman that actually addressed this question of topologies, three-dimensional topologies?
Well, it doesn't solve the classification problem.
Okay.
Only in two dimensions, the theory that is not modular entirely doesn't mean that you cannot put it on the plane.
Yes. Correct.
So we don't have to demand that.
If you just want to know things about the plane, you don't have to demand that. But we usually do. It's a bit strange that, we usually don't call that a consistent CFT if it doesn't satisfy modular invariance. And that's exactly what we are doing in higher dimensions, is calling consistent CFTs things that don't necessarily satisfy.
How do you know that n equals 4 is consistent?
Yeah. I would go wrong.
No, if you have a path integral definition, then it necessarily satisfies. I mean, I just showed that you do this coordinate transformation and it obeys. I'm saying, but if you give an algebraic definition of the theory in terms of deltas and OP coefficients, then you don't know. You need to input more constraints. So let me just pose the problem in 5 minutes, and then we finish. So, because I don't know much about topology in higher dimensions, let's look at the torus, okay? So a torus in higher dimensions is just, you just have more coordinates, xd, and you do the same identification, okay? Plus, let's use the 2 pi, n1, nd. But now you face the, what metric do you put on this torus, okay? Now there's no theorem that tells you that you can reduce the metric to being flat just with this parameter. So again, we face the problem. But I want to be conservative, and I'll say, okay, I want to study a particular class of metrics on the torus, which are metrics that are just constant coefficients, okay? These guys are constant, so it's flat. Okay? This is my choice. I can choose to study the partition function in this d-dimensional torus. And then the partition function will be a function of these parameters in the metric. In fact, it will be a function of the ratios, because you can always bring one out by an overall rescaling. But it will be a function of the ratios, the partition function. So here, g are really constants, constant matrix. But now, so the first part of the story, you can do exactly the same. So if you do a transformation, and a coordinate transformation like this, which now is an SL, so if you do a coordinate transformation like x mu equals m mu nu x tilde nu, where m is a matrix, or m mu nu is a matrix of SL d comma z, so unit matrix of integer coefficients, again, you map the torus to the torus in a one-to-one way, and the metric changes. It's very easy to see. The metric in the becomes just g mu nu, m mu alpha, m nu beta, dx alpha, dx beta. So this is your new set of constant numbers, g alpha beta. So the metric should be invariant. So the partition function should be invariant. It should be equal to this, let's call this, sorry, g tilde of mu nu, this new matrix formed by acting with SL2z, SLDZ matrix. So it's clear that there is a partition function in, like, even in the simplest possible case that has non-trivial symmetries. Now, really, the non-trivial part now is this statement. Because here, why is this determined in terms of delta i's? Is because you can interpret this partition function on the torus as really the partition function of the theory on the cylinder. You evolve the cylinder over some Euclidean time, and then you identify it. So here, what's the natural partition function would be the path integral on SD minus 1 times S1, and not the torus. Okay, so the natural thing that is completely determined by the spectrum is not this partition function. So there are, at least I can think of two alternative situations. Or, so one situation is this function is actually completely determined by deltas and the CIJKs, okay? So one situation is determined by delta i's and CIJ's, the usual CFT data,
If that is true, then we have extra constraints. We just have to find the way of how to actually write this partition function in terms of this data, and then we have extra constraints that we are not studying. But I really don't know how to see that. So I think the option, but this is my guess. I think that what's really happening is that for higher dimensional CFTs, if you want to study them in background with non-trivial topology, this data is not enough to define the theory. So even if you know all the delta i's and all the CIJ's, you will not be able to write down the partition function of the torus. I think there's extra information needed. How do you do that?
If you know all correlations, you can expand the metric around plus two.
But if I knew all of the correlators in the plane, won't I know all of the correlators on the torus just using some kind of method of images?
But what about the partition function itself? You say that with insertions, you just use the method of image. But what about the without insertion? Without insertions, I think it's I don't know how to do it. Maybe if there's a way, it would be wonderful to write this function and see what constraints come up. But I don't know how to do it.
Won't you get constraints in the ST minus one process, right?
Right. So, but here one has to think. One has to think, what are these non-trivial transformations? In this torus, it was trivial. Right? It's just SLDZ. So here, there are also constraints. In fact, Kyriakos explores this point of view, and essentially just by demanding, thinking of this as really a partition function, a theory at finite temperature, so it has to be consistent. We know the scaling of the free energy at high temperature, for example. That already fixes non-trivial. That already gives extra constraints. So just demanding that.
You will have the constraint that tau goes to minus 1 over tau will be replaced by the interchange of the radians.
No, that's not a coordinate transformation that keeps the form of the metric. I mean, there's no way to implement that. That's not an invariance, yeah. You have to think of something more non-trivial. Anyway, sorry for taking so long. I want to finish here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.